Good afternoon, guys. My name is JD, and I want to welcome all of you back to GNG's Think Bible podcast. This podcast has been a lot of fun for us as a church family, and the Bible reading plan that we've been following through the Read Scripture app has been generating a ton of really interesting questions and discussion. And I want to start this morning by just applauding all of you who are participating in the reading plan and the podcasts, and to encourage you to just keep it up. The learning that we're doing is definitely going to help all of us grow in our individual relationships with God and will strengthen us as a church. So today's podcast is going to be a little bit of a mixture and a mix and match of different material. For those of you who attended church on Sunday, I gave a lesson called Providence or Politics, and it was all about the Bible and how the Bible came into its current format. If you haven't yet heard that lesson, I would absolutely invite you to check that out on our website. But as I mentioned in the lesson, there was no way that I could cover all of the material about the Bible's production and its passage through time in one 55 minute lesson. So today I want to double back and hit you guys with some material that I didn't get to cover in the lesson. But I also want to cover an interesting story from the end of the book of Numbers. So here goes. I want to start this podcast by asking you a really important question. What do you think that the Bible is for? Have you ever thought about that? If not, then just take a second right now to kind of think about it. What do you think the Bible is for? For some of you, the immediate answers are probably something like life change. The Bible's here to teach us how to live so that we can be better people. Some of you may have thought that the Bible is for telling us about Jesus. And all of those things are true. But to get at what the Bible is for, I want to ask you a quick Bible trivia question. Now, seriously, if you want to impress people this coming weekend, just ask them this question and wow them with the fact that you know the answer. I'm just kidding, but here goes anyway. All right, Bible trivia time. Do any of you know the first place in the Bible that the Bible talks about the writing of the Bible? Okay, so where is the first place in the Bible where it talks about the writing of the Bible? Do you know? Have a clue? I'll give you a hint. If you're sticking with the Bible reading plan so far, you've already read it. It's in Exodus chapter 17. And what's going on in Exodus chapter 17 is that the people of Israel have left Egypt. They have left slavery, and they've headed out through the wilderness. They've already gone through the Red Sea and everything that happened with Pharaoh's army there. And they're walking through the wilderness. And in Exodus chapter 17, a group of people called the Amalekites come out and attack the people of Israel at Rephidim. So the Israelites are out there, and Moses realizes, hey, these people are going to attack us, and he gets Joshua and says, choose some of our men to go out and fight the Amalekites. And he tells Joshua something really interesting. He says, tomorrow, when you go out to fight these guys, I'm going to stand at the top of this hill with the staff of God in my hands to watch the battle. And so the next morning, Joshua and his group of warriors get up and they get ready to go, and the Amalekites are coming to attack them. And Moses and his brother Aaron and another guy named Hur walk to the top of a hill not far from their camp. And the Bible tells us this really interesting story. It says that when Moses held up his hands, in other words, when he held his hands up, the Israelite soldiers were winning the battle. But, you know, Moses is kind of old at this time, and, you know, he gets kind of tired. And so his hands ultimately fall. And what they notice is that when his hands go down, the people of Israel start losing. And so Aaron and Hur get him something to sit on, and they stand beside him, and they hold his hands up. And ultimately, Israel wins the battle, and they send the Amalekite army running. And then something really interesting happens. Okay. In chapter 17, verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. This is literally the first time in the Bible that we get any reference to the writing of the Bible. So let's break this down for a second. What was he supposed to write down? He was supposed to write down a story. And what's the story about? Well, the story is about God. The God that Moses and the other Israelites believed created the world and loved people and made a relationship with their family. And what did God do? He saved the Israelites from a group of people who had attacked them. So whatever we think the Bible is for, it really does kind of need to take this into account. You see, the Bible is a story about the God who created the world and wants to save people. Oh, I'm going to repeat that. The Bible is a story. Okay, so right off the front, we understand that the Bible, the whole narrative from the front to the back, tells us a story. And the story is about the God who made the world, you and me, and everything in it. And ultimately, that his goal is to save us through a relationship with him. Now see, the Bible goes on to show that God doesn't just simply want to save us from marauding attackers. He wants to save us from our sins, from the things that make us distant from him. But the simple fact of the matter is that the God who created the world wants to save people, and the Bible tells us the story about how he's bringing that plan into action. So let me ask you another Bible trivia question. What's the second time inside the Bible that it talks about the writing of the Bible? Well, you've also read it. It's only a couple of chapters later, actually. So in the chapters following this battle against the Amalekites, in Exodus chapters 19 and 20, Moses goes up on Mount Sinai and he comes back down with this list of rules. And if you've seen the movie, you know that we call these rules the Ten Commandments. So in Exodus 20, we read the Ten Commandments, and the chapters immediately after that result in God giving the Israelites some additional laws and rules. Simply put, the idea of these rules was to lay out how human beings could actually have a relationship with God. You see, we already talked about the Bible's a story about the God who created the world and wants to save people through a relationship with him. Well, this next section where the Bible talks about the writing of the Bible shows us that God has given us some rules for how we can have that relationship that will allow him to save us. And see, these rules make up what's known as a covenant. And a covenant is a really interesting word. We don't use that word very often. But the idea of it is a legally binding relationship of love and allegiance between two people. That's typically why we refer to a marriage as a covenant. But in this particular situation, it's God coming to this group of people known as the Israelites and saying, I want to have a covenant with you. It's almost kind of like saying God coming to them and going, hey, I want to marry you. I want to be in this loving relationship and this legally binding contract between you and me. And so Moses gets all these laws, and he goes down to the people of Israel, and he tells them about it. And then in Exodus chapter 24, verses 3 and 4, we get the second mentioning of the writing of the Bible in the Bible. And it goes like this. Then Moses went down to the people, and he repeated all the instructions and regulations the Lord had given him. So not just the Ten Commandments, but all the other laws. And he comes down, and he gives them to the people of Israel, and he tells them about it. And he said, this is what it takes to have a relationship with God. And all the people answered with one voice, we will do everything the Lord has commanded. So Moses comes down. He gives the people all the instructions and regulations that God had given him. All the people say, yes, we want that relationship. We want that covenant. We'll do it. And then in verse 4, then Moses carefully wrote down all the Lord's instructions. So whatever we think the Bible is for, we also have to kind of make room for this. That the Bible is not just a story about the God who created the world and wants to save people. The Bible is also a guide for how people can have a relationship with God. You see, this theme even extends into the New Testament. Jesus, right before he went back to heaven, told his disciples, "All authority in heaven on earth, in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit." And this is the important part, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. Think about that. How did they go into all the world? How did they teach people everything Jesus commanded? Well, they traveled for sure, but they wrote. They wrote the New Testament, which is basically a new and updated guidebook for how to have a relationship with God. And they wrote this as a way of encouraging these new disciples. So when we put it all together, when we look over the entire Bible and what it's really for, we have to remember, the Bible is a story about how God creates, loves, and saves people. And it's a guidebook for how God invites people to be in a relationship with Him. So, speaking of the New Testament, I had to move rather quickly regarding how the New Testament canon came together on this past Sunday. Canon, you'll remember if you were there, is just a Greek word for authority or rule, and it basically means the books that comprise the authorized and accepted New Testament. Now, Jesus, most scholars believe, lived from approximately 3 BC to 30 AD, somewhere in that vicinity. And all of the evidence suggests that all of the books making up the New Testament were complete somewhere between 90 and 100 AD, which is less than 70 years after Jesus was walking the earth. But as I mentioned in the lesson on Sunday, it took a long time for the different books and letters of the New Testament to travel to all of the churches around the Roman Empire. Ultimately, it wasn't until 367 AD when Athanasius, a Christian scholar and theologian in northern Africa, produced the first full list of all the 27 books of the New Testament as we have it today. So what took so long? Why was it almost 300 years or more until a full list of all the books of the New Testament was compiled? And what was the timeline for that? So let me start by addressing why it took so long to arrive at the full canon of the New Testament. First of all, we have to remember that the New Testament was largely a group of letters sent to various individual churches across a vast Roman Empire. It took quite a while for all the churches to even know about all the letters and the writings of the apostles. You can kind of think about this in terms of there were churches as far away as Turkey to Rome to northern Africa. There were loads of churches and loads of towns all over Greece and Turkey and modern-day Palestine and down into Africa. It took a great amount of time, especially when you consider that they didn't have easy communication back then, for the churches to even know that these letters and writings were out there. Secondly, no one scroll could easily contain more than one or two books. So the books were copied and recorded pretty much one at a time, making the process very slow. This resulted in it taking time for these scrolls to make their rounds through the churches in the Roman world. Thirdly, the early church accepted the authority and honesty of the apostles and early writers of the New Testament text as having authority in and of themselves. You see, these guys walked with Jesus. They knew him personally. They saw the miracles. They saw the healings. They saw him die. They saw him rise again. And so the various churches simply trusted that, oh, hey, this letter is from Peter, or hey, this letter is from Paul. They knew Jesus, so we can trust that they're writing the truth. In other words, they considered anything written by the apostles as scriptural, so they didn't feel the need to compile a list of accepted scriptures until other false writings started to appear. So as frustrating as that may be for modern people going, well, why didn't they have a list, and why does it look like the list changed over time? Well, the simple fact of the matter is they didn't feel like they needed a list. Hey, it was written by an apostle, good enough for me. And that's kind of how that worked. it wasn't until number four, when the Gnostic gospel started making their rounds until in the second and third centuries, that the church realized, hey, we need a list of what's real and what's fake, because these books are obviously fake. The Gnostic Gospels were immediately rejected by all of the church leaders at the time. But once these things started hitting the market and people started hearing about them and reading them, they wanted to make sure that the churches knew, hey, this is what's real and this is what's fake. Finally, around the 300s AD, the churches were experiencing significant persecution by the Romans. And there was plenty of it before then, but around the 300s it was pretty significant. In 303 AD, the Roman Emperor Diocletian ordered that every copy of the Christian Bible found was to be burned. And Christians were often killed during this time. And it was under this intense persecution that the church recognized, you know, hey, we really probably better know which books we need to die for and which books we can say, yeah, we don't believe that. those are some of the reasons why it took a long time for a specific list of the New Testament books to be created. So let's kind of talk timeline for a second. The earliest reported canon of the New Testament, or grouping of New Testament books, is called the Muratorian canon. And it is dated around 150 AD, so about 120 or 30 years after Jesus. It contained 22 of our current 27 New Testament books. But by 200 AD, so just another 50 years down the road, the famous church theologian Tertullian quoted and wrote about nearly all of the New Testament books. And he equated them as on the level as the New Testament. You can read his writings on that today. He referred to the New and Old Testaments with the phrase, the majesty of our scriptures. So by 240 AD, and I mentioned this on Sunday, Origen of Alexandria, the teacher and theologian from northern Africa, was using all 27 of the New Testament books and only those. He didn't use any of the Gnostic Gospels. He didn't agree with any of the pseudepigrapha writings that I've mentioned on Sunday. He wrote and discussed those 27 books as having equal footing with the Old Testament. And ultimately, it's with the writings of Athanasius in the mid-300s that our New Testament canon was written down in its current form. So in a world with no immediate and quick communication, it took around 200 years for all of the books to be recognized as scripture, and in about 300 years for a final list to be written down. Notice, however, that nowhere in this history that I've mentioned is there any evidence about the idea that books were decided upon by political councils. That's just not what happened. So we've talked kind of about the Bible and its production, and I mentioned at the beginning that I wanted to discuss one quick story from the book of Numbers. As we close today's podcast, I want to jump into the end of Book of Numbers, and specifically chapter 32, and talk about one particular story. Moses has led the people all the way to the doorway of the Promised Land. Behind them are 40 years of wandering around in the wilderness, and the people are getting ready to launch into the land that God had promised to give them. When these two tribes come up to Moses and say, "You know what, Moses? You know what, God? We'd really rather not." So if you have a Bible with you, flip over to Numbers chapter 32, and it goes like this. The Reubenites and Gadites, the tribes of Reuben and Gad, who had very large herds and flocks, saw that the land of Jazer and Gilead were suitable for livestock. So they came to Moses and Eleazar and the priests and the leaders of the community and said, "Hey, these towns that we're currently in right now, the land that the Lord has subdued before us recently, are suitable for livestock, and your servants have livestock. If we have found favor in your eyes," they said, "let this land be given to your servants as our possession. Do not make us cross the Jordan." So think about this. For over 400 years, all the way back to when Abraham and God made their agreement in Genesis chapter 15, God had promised that he would bring all of Abraham's family to this land, and that the land would be great and bountiful and good and flowing with milk and honey and all these wonderful images. And now these two tribes are checking out. And Moses proceeds to light into them. All right. Verse 6. Moses said to the Gadites and Reubenites, "Shall your countrymen go to war while you sit here? Why do you discourage the Israelites from going over into the land that the Lord has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to look over the land. And after they went up the valley of Eshcol and viewed the land, they discouraged the Israelites from entering the land the Lord had given them. The Lord's anger was aroused that day, and he swore this oath, because they have not followed me wholeheartedly. Not one of the men 20 years old or more who came up out of Egypt will see the land that I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not one, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite, and Joshua, son of Nun, for they followed the Lord wholeheartedly. The Lord's anger burned against Israel, and he made them wander in the desert 40 years until this whole generation of those who had done evil in his sight was gone. And here you are, a brood of sinners, standing in the place of your fathers and making the Lord even more angry with Israel. If you turn away from following him, he will leave all his people at the desert, and you will be the cause of their destruction." I mean, he is angry. He's basically saying, you know, you guys are just like the 10 spies who went into the land and spied it out and then came back and told us we couldn't have it. That event caused the people to spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness, and Moses was not having any of it. But the two tribes in the following verses go on to promise that they will help their fellow tribes get into the land by helping to fight for them and secure their inheritance. So let's think about this story for just a second. What led them to stop short of the promised land? Why did they choose not to go in with their brothers and sisters? Well, on the surface, we can look at verse 1. The Reubenites and Gadites, who had very large herds and flocks, saw that the lands of Jazer and Gilead were suitable for livestock. So they had a lot of livestock, and the land they were in was a good fit for livestock. Now, it's not that the promised land wasn't. It was fine for that. But this was a good land for herds and cattle, and they had already subdued it. And these guys were just kind of like, you know what, let's just hang out here. Jewish historians note that during this period in history, wealth and prosperity was measured in livestock, not cash. And so these two tribes were among the more wealthy of the Israelites. And let's just look at the importance that the livestock held in their minds. Check out verse 16. "Then they came up to him and said, 'We would like to build pens for our livestock and cities for our women and children.'" Now notice something. Which came first? They were more concerned about the livestock than even their women and children. This point is actually pounded home further when Moses responds to them, because he flips the order of importance. You know, whereas in verse 16 they said, "We would like to build pens for our livestock first, and then cities for our women and children," in verse 24, Moses says, "Build cities for your women and children, and pens for your livestock." So he flips the order and tells them, you know, hey, get your priorities straight. Now, Moses ultimately allows them to stay on the eastern side of the Jordan, separated from the other tribes of Israel and separated from the tabernacle of God, which was the place of God's presence. And unfortunately, much as the spies had discouraged the people from entering the land 40 years before, the tribes of Reuben and Gad discouraged half of another tribe from going in. You see, the half-tribe of Manasseh joined them in remaining outside of the promised land. So not only had they separated themselves from the rest of Israel, this action tore another tribe in half. So what happened to these two and a half tribes? Well, in the book of Joshua, we will ultimately see when we get to that reading that the separation of these two and a half tribes almost results in a civil war with the other nine and a half in the promised land. Furthermore, these tribes eventually mixed in with neighboring people groups, such as the Midianites, and they began worshiping false gods. Eventually, these two tribes were the first to be sent into exile. So what can we learn from this situation? I think there are two really important things. First of all, God has a great plan for our lives if we will follow and serve Him. But he will let us settle for less if we want to. You see, God will not force us to experience His blessings, and He will not make us wait for His goodness. You and I will all face the temptation to rush into a lesser blessing as opposed to being patient enough to wait for God to come through and bless us in a big way. You've probably seen that in your own life or in the lives of someone around, the lives of people around you. And really, the question that we have to answer is, do we trust God enough, and will we let God have His way in us enough to experience all the good that He has for us? These 2.5 tribes didn't, and they paid for it in many ways over the next several hundred years. Secondly, separating ourselves from God and from a community of believers always results in a dangerous and unhealthy situation. You see, we as people of faith were never meant to isolate ourselves from God and others. But you'll say, hey, they didn't really isolate themselves because there were 2.5 tribes together. The problem is that bad spiritual company is the same as no spiritual company. These tribes made an idol of their possessions and their livestock, and they separated themselves from God and from their brothers and sisters. We would do well to remember that as imperfect as our church family may be, remaining in community is still the best way of staying close to God. We will make better choices when we're in community than we will outside of it. I thought it was funny the other night in our programming meeting. One of our leaders made a really interesting statement. She's following through with all of the reading in the Old Testament. She's been hanging in there with the Bible reading plan, and she described Israel as a hot mess. And she's right. As we have tracked the people of Israel, they were always screwing up in their relationship with God. And trust me, sometimes those of us here at GNG are a hot mess too. But using that as an excuse to separate ourselves from a spiritual family only results in degrading our relationships with God and significant personal, relational, and spiritual consequences for ourselves. Guys, I hope you are really enjoying the reading plan and that you stick with it, no matter if you fall a little bit behind. Now, the learning that we are doing is so important, and it will grow us if we let it. So, thanks for joining us today, and until next time, remember to think biblically, think logically, and think honestly.